former Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm has died. On today's program, you will hear remarks from Chisholm made at the National Press Club in 1972. But first, a one-on-one interview with Chisholm by Denny Luna.
Thank you, Bob. On this edition of Like It Is, I'm talking with Shirley Chisholm, one of the most influential women of our time. Thank you for being here.
Certainly, I'm very glad to be here.
You were the first African-American woman elected to Congress, and you always maintained that it was more difficult for you as a woman than an African-American in Congress. Can you explain that?
Yes, certainly. People find that rather surprising, but you have to remember that men are men, whether they are white, black, Indian, they're men. And all men, most men seem to have a predisposition to the role that women should play in any society. And I found that when I made a bid for the presidency, when I ran for Congress, that I actually met more discrimination being a woman than being of the black race. Men held certain private meetings to discuss what are we going to do with Shirley Chisholm. And it was not only white men that did this, black men did it. So that it's just this general feeling that men have, if they're white men or black men, about the role of women. I certainly met more discrimination as a woman.
When you walked into the halls of Congress for the very first time, it was a historic moment. And you must have had a lot of different feelings going through you at that moment. Can you recall what it was like to first walk into that Congress?
Well, I remembered when I entered the halls of Congress, and as they opened the door and I walked through, it was so funny. Again, so many of the men just kind of stood back. It was very, very funny to me. They just stood back and just gaped at me. And for the moment, I thought I had descended from another planet. I mean, I felt so strange. But I could understand why that happened. And in the very beginning, I met some discrimination, but in a few instances, they found that I was a no-nonsense person, that I was not going to take it. So the word went around amongst all of them, don't fool with her. She knows what she's about. And then I got right into living with the men in the Congress, and we all became friends. Within 6 months, I was really accepted.
Looking back, politics has always been so much of your life, even when you were in college, later as a New York Assemblywoman, and later on in Congress. What is it about politics that's so interesting to you, that makes it so much a part of your life?
Well, I think when I was in high school, I began to be a community activist. I've been very involved in my community for a long time. And I recognized that in order to get things done, and in order to make sure that these things would be effective, that you had to be involved in politics. I learned about this business of legislation. I learned about the fact that you have to get bills passed, and the bills have to be signed into law, and then signed by the president in terms of a national basis, and signed by the governor if you operate in statewide. So I became interested in politics because it was a means to an end. It was so important that because I had an interest in the problems and the concerns of people, I wanted to do something. I wanted something to happen. In order to make it happen, I had to become involved in the political arena.
Many were saddened when you did retire from Congress, and I know you still remain very active. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the activities that the most interest you at this time?
Oh, at this time, I'm approaching the age of 73. I am in a state of semi-retirement. I have moved to Florida, and I have been rather quiet. I have been active for about 38 years of my life in the political arena, and so now I am kind of quiet. I do some lecturing. I have a few community projects in which I am involved, but for the most part, I just sit and read books. I love to read. I have over 3,000 books in my own home library. So I catch up on my reading, and I'm leading a quiet, nice life now.
As far as issues go, you were a pioneer in a number of fields, education, civil rights, social services. What stands out for you as a highlight or highlights?
I think one of the things that stands out for me was the fact when I got the Title I of the Education Act. That particular measure gave to young people an opportunity to really get into this mainstream of education. Young people who were disadvantaged, young people who didn't have a chance. I felt very proud about that. Then also the minimum wage law for domestics. I was the first person to be able to get the minimum wage laws applied to domestics. Every time we came to a minimum wage in the Congress, it involved every person except domestics. It involved agricultural workers and other kinds of service workers. But the poor domestics, of which 70% are Hispanic and black women, they never got the chance to do it. So I was involved in that, and I got that law passed. And I consider those two things, the two of the most important things to me, because they're involved children and women.
You wrote a book called Unbought and Unbossed. And to remain unbought and unbossed in Congress must have been a challenge.
Oh, yes, that was really a challenge, because I was always told that in order to be an effective legislator, it would be most important for you to be connected with lobby groups. You would have to behave yourself in order to go along. And I just couldn't buy that. In my entire life in politics, I have not been in anybody's pockets. Oh, I suffered as a result of it, because the political leadership in the legislative bodies always make sure I didn't get certain little perks because I wouldn't behave myself. But I don't regret it one bit. And that's why my slogan throughout my entire political career was unbought, because I didn't belong to anybody, and unbossed, and nobody could boss me around. So that's hence the title of the book, Unbought and Unbossed.
In 1972, you ran as a viable candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. And what are your thoughts over 20 years later of the significance of that event?
Well, I think the significance of that was that by my running, I opened the door. That's all I meant. I just opened the door, because when I began to run for the office, people thought I was crazy. People thought I was kooky. People said, she forgets she's black. All kinds of remarks were thrust in my direction. But in anything that I do, I look only to God and to my conscience for approval. I don't look to any man walking this earth, and I use that term man generically. I don't look to any man walking this earth, because if I did, I wouldn't have arrived at where I am today. So that I opened the door for Jesse Jackson, Geraldine Ferraro, and all these other people, women and blacks, who came along after. That was only the importance of that run that I made.
You're listening to Like It Is, and we're speaking with Shirley Chisholm. What do women bring to Congress?
Oh, women bring to Congress a whole variety of ideas and an entire variety of issues that are not handled by men. Particularly in the area of children's legislation and elderly citizens' legislation, it is so important that women are there to vocalize on these particular issues. Because men, for whatever the reasons may be, do not pay particular attention to the children who cannot vote. They're not vote getters there, and to the older people. So that women bring a whole new set of perspectives to the legislative process, and women are very, very important in the legislative process. In fact, we don't have enough women yet, although we have been increasing. We still don't have enough women in the legislative bodies.
What are particular barriers to women running for Congress?
Oh, the particular barriers. I think the main barrier is this question of money. You worry about where are you going to get the finances to make a bid for a political office. And men and women in general are not as willing to invest money in the campaigns of women. But it's changing, though. I could see when I emerged some years ago in politics, I could see the difference then and now. That is becoming more acceptable now, but money is very, very important. And certain standards that are not applicable to men are thrust upon women. They will tell you, well, you have to be articulate. Well, there's so many men I meet who are so not articulate, and yet people will vote for them for office. And then they'll tell you, you have to be able to be strong and tougher. And all of these things they tell you, and I think in a sense it's really to make women feel that they just don't have the capability of running for political office.
In what ways is this country moving backwards and forwards? I mean, is it maybe a mix?
Well, you know, progress never proceeds smoothly. It has its setbacks and it has its gains. And right now, we're going through a very retrogressive era. All of the things that women fought for during the years that the women's rights movement came into being, and all of the things that blacks fought for, the struggle for the civil rights, we have steadily seen an erosion of these gains in different ways. We've seen an erosion legislatively. We've seen an erosion in terms of the decisions that are made by the Supreme Court. There is a terrible setback that we are now going through in this country. But I'm an eternal optimist, but that too shall pass.
Looking at the future, what are some issues that we need as women and as Americans to focus on in the years ahead?
Well, the one issue is discrimination. Racism. Racism is the bugaboo of America. It makes America so vulnerable to the attacks of her opponents, both within this country and outside of this country. And I don't know if we'll ever, ever really deal forthrightly with the question of racism in this country. And that's all I say, racism and discrimination, the thing that is going to really determine where this country is going to be 100 years from now.
As you look back over your life, do you consider yourself blessed?
Well, yes, I do consider myself blessed. I went through a great deal of difficulty in terms of being a first to run for president, first black woman to be elected to the Congress, first black woman to go to the New York State Legislature. I have been a first in many instances, but I am glad. I'm blessed because I feel I had the capacity to be able to be a very resilient person and to be able to have so much confidence in myself so that I could get through. And I feel, although I met many difficulties, and God knows I went through many kinds of difficulties, the fact is that I succeeded. And I succeeded because of my will, my determination, the conviction, and the commitment I have to what I was about.
Thank you and best wishes. My guest on Like It Is has been former Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm.
Fellow pundits and voters, every red-blooded American boy grows up knowing he can be president someday. But for a woman, black or white, to aspire to the highest office in the land, no way. In the good old days, that is. Of course, you all remember Victoria Woodhull. That's right. She ran for the presidency in 1872, 100 years ago, on a slogan of free love and equal rights. Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm has stolen half her platform. Then another predecessor, Belva Lockwood, who ran for the presidency in 1884, and asked the pioneer Negro civil rights leader, Frederick Douglass, to be her running mate. He turned her down, obviously thinking the country was not ready for a woman or a black. But we've come a long way, baby. And they call her Fighting Shirley Chisholm, who weighs in at 98 pounds. And as a black and a woman, she obviously has two advantages over her male white opponents. There are some, of course, who might not see it that way. Even perhaps the congresswoman who calls herself the majority minority candidate. She also doesn't mind labeling herself a dark horse. She's highly qualified to represent her district in New York because she was born there. She was graduated from Girls High School in Brooklyn, where she must have started a women's lib movement in her teens. From there, she went to Brooklyn College, where she received a BA degree, graduating cum laude. At Columbia University, she earned her MA degree in education, and she's been trying to teach her colleagues in Congress a thing or two ever since. In 1964, she entered politics, running successfully for the New York State Assembly on the Democratic ticket from her melting pot district. The next step up the political ladder was her election to the 91st Congress. Unlike most of her colleagues who learned fast that freshmen are to be seen and not heard, she made her stand early in the game. When the powers that be assigned her to the House Agriculture Subcommittee on Forestry and Rural Villages, she made an unprecedented protest. She said, the only thing they knew about Brooklyn was that a tree once grew there. To keep peace in the House, she was assigned to the Veterans Affairs Committee, more relevant for her. In 1949, she took time out to get married to a non-chauvinist male, a Jamaica-born private eye, whose ego is still intact. He's proud of her and is the first to say she rates star billing in their family. She agrees. When she tossed her bonnet in the ring on January 25, it was not an empty gesture. She means business, and she has a seven-letter word, baloney, for those who say she's only splintering further an already fragmented liberal wing of the party. She's running on a shoestring, but has people power, a faithful following of now women, blacks, and Chicanos. Her slogan, unbossed and unbought, is also the title of her autobiography and a way of life for her. She was, of course, appalled when Senator Muskie said that he doubted that the country was ready for a black vice president. She says when she took Muskie around Bedford-Stuyvesant in 1968, she did not question whether the country was ready for a Polish vice president. When she turned down the Gridiron Club's unprecedented invitation to their annual dinner a couple of weeks ago, she blasted the elite correspondents for, quote, racism and sexism. Gentlemen, she wrote, guess who is not coming to dinner? Ladies and gentlemen, guess who has come to lunch with us? It is my honor to present Ms. Shirley Chisholm.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. First of all, I'm very glad to have been able to come here this afternoon and to share with you some of my thoughts on the problems that concern all of America today. I'm also very glad that you did have some kind of revolution within this organization, because it is my firm belief that in our nation today, the nation needs the capabilities and the talents of the best kind of brain power that we have, and as yet there is no psychological test that indicates that one sex has a superiority of gray matter over another. They're very intelligent men and very intelligent women. They're very stupid men and very stupid women. And we need to stop getting so hung up on sex psychologically, intellectually, physically, and put together the kind of talent that is very, very necessary to get this ship of state straightened out. Remember, for a long time, ever since the inception of the Republic, only one segment of America has been making most of the decisions that govern all of our lives. It's time now for some of the other segments to do so. And I just made my mind up that I'm going to start the ball rolling. Now, for more than 8 years, the American people have sat by helplessly while two administrations huddled in special crisis centers in the White House. the State Department, and the Pentagon, poring over maps, selecting new targets to destroy, glossing over atrocities, racking their brains to think of such phrases as protective reaction strikes and Vietnamization, and moving troops in and out, first in South Vietnam, then Cambodia, and then Laos. And for most of the 1960s and the first 2.5 years of the 70s, the American government has been engrossed in answering such questions as, what weapons can be employed here? How many bombs and napalm should be dropped there? How can we get our casualties off the front pages? How much more time can we buy with this speech and that speech to the American people? How long will the public tolerate news of widespread heroin addiction among our troops? Is the public dutifully impressed with the latest body counts? How can we cover up the tiger cages, the swarms of refugees, the black market in Saigon, the murder and assassination program of Operation Phoenix, the prostitution, the deforestation and physical destruction of vast areas of the Vietnamese countryside, My Lai, the Pentagon Papers, the embarrassing claims of victory by ambassadors and generals year after year for the past 8 years? In the name of God, I ask, what conceivable gain can be worth? Can all of this be worth to us? Is there no end to this insanity, this grotesque absorption in war, and all of its offshoots has virtually destroyed the ability of this government to function effectively at home and to respond to the process of change and evolution which our society is going through today? One weeps before the fact of floundering administrations rendered impotent by war and the puppet of forces over which they have lost all control, while the nation is plagued by problems that are growing worse. Huge areas of rotten, rat-infested housing in noisy, decaying cities. Health care so expensive it is hopelessly beyond the reach of millions of Americans. The deluge of shabby, contaminated, and worthless junk in the economic marketplace. And the millions of able-bodied men and women, particularly the nation's youth, unable to find work, and the continued and persistent exclusion of millions of blacks and Chicanas and Puerto Ricans and Indians and women and young people from productive participation in our social, in our political, and in our economic life. Counterproductive and violent system of law enforcement and punishment. The continuing fouling of the air, our lakes and our rivers and our streams, and the power, the overwhelming power of giant, untouchable corporations in this nation, soaring prices for the bare necessities of life, and an educational system so appalling that teachers around the country have virtually given up on teaching their students, while the students themselves often leave school hopelessly ill-equipped to deal with the aforementioned problems of this, our nation. Yes. One trembles with rage to think of all these urgent problems, any one of which by itself is very critical, begging the attention of a government which has consistently responded only with lies and deceit, and the monstrous ongoing sacrifice of America's young men and the taxpayers' dollar. And the record of this nation's leadership in Washington regarding Vietnam constitutes a wretched betrayal of the just expectations and the just needs of the American people. And the fact that we have now rushed more jets and more bombers and helicopters and battleships to Vietnam, that we now have 7 aircraft carriers stationed off its shores, with the Saratoga reportedly assigned to at least 8 months' duty there, and the fact that more B-52 bombers than ever before are bombing Hanoi and Haiphong once again, brings us full circle back to 1968, 4 years ago.
The remarks of former Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm of New York. Her comments to the National Press Club were made in 1972. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of like it is.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.